From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The new president of the University of North Carolina believes higher education should be a civil right. Margaret Spellings used her official installation ceremony to make her case. You'll hear highlights. State government threatens private property rights when it misuses the power of eminent domain. You'll hear from an attorney who's working to fight that abuse of power. The U.S. economy could benefit greatly from business tax reform. A Heritage Foundation expert offered that argument during a recent speech in Charlotte. He shares his views with Carolina Journal Radio. Republican Richard Burr held off a tough challenge from Democrat Deborah Ross to win his third and final term as North Carolina's senior U.S. Senator. You'll hear highlights from Burr's election night victory speech and comments from Ross's concession. And speaking of elections, Donna Martinez tackles that topic as she joins us now with a Carolina Journal headline.
When North Carolina Senator Richard Burr heads back to Washington and the U.S. Senate following his election victory over Deborah Ross, he will be working with a White House led by fellow Republican Donald Trump. Now, that scenario is likely to mean more opportunity for movement and reform on issues of key importance to conservatives and possibly libertarians as well. Carolina Journal Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins me now with a look at several of those issues. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Healthcare seems like it's going to be a priority, and at the top of the list is the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Mm-hmm. Now, the Trump who campaigned talked about repealing and replacing Obamacare. So let's start with that first. Are there really things that could chip away at Obamacare?
Yes, there are, and it was surprising to actually see that this could be done without actually having a vote to dismantle the act necessarily. But Michael Cannon of the Cato Institute posted that there are some things that by executive order a President Trump could do. Of course, congressional cooperation would help. But
right.
Some things that President Trump could do to, in effect, defenestrate Obamacare. One thing, he could say that the government would no longer provide subsidies that have been ruled unconstitutional by a federal judge, which has happened. They said that some of those subsidies are not constitutional. Also, the Government Accountability Office found that some subsidies that were being handed out by federal or state governments were not appropriate. And so he could say, we're not going to pay those anymore. And also, he said that that Donald Trump could say, if insurance companies come to the federal government for a bailout because they're losing money on their Obamacare policies, too bad. And this would be in a line with his, I'm not going to bail out big financial institutions. I'm not going to be on the side of the big banks, that sort of thing. And then the fourth thing is he could simply say that Congress can no longer exempt itself from Obamacare.
Oh, boy, that's likely to get their attention
that
quickly.
Members of Congress are going to have to sign up for Affordable Care Act policies. And he could do that by executive order. Or if Congress refused to go along with that, then, of course, that would cause a huge public relations nightmare for the new Congress. So there are things like that that could basically cause the Affordable Care Act to go into a financial cascade downhill. And that could, in effect, prod Congress to do something quickly about it.
Now, you mentioned congressional involvement and all that. We've heard some opponents of Obamacare say, why don't they just defund it? Would that be an option, too, to work directly with Congress on that?
That could be done, yes. And that would be something that would be a little more complicated because it does involve changes in the tax code and things like that. But there are certain things that Michael Cannon pointed out that are in the control of the executive branch to agree to pay. And so Congress could do that. I think the problem with doing away with Obamacare immediately is that unless you have some plan in place to handle things like people who have who lose their health insurance because they change jobs, or they hit an income threshold because of Medicaid eligibility, that sort of thing. Those sorts of transitions are going to have to be ready. And, well, fortunately, our senior senator happens to have devised a plan that would take care of many of those things, and he introduced it here several years ago and talked about it at the John Locke Foundation.
And, of course, you're talking about Senator Richard Burr, who was just reelected. So that'll be interesting to see what relationship develops between Senator Burr and the White House. One other thing that Senator Burr has been working on has to do with FDA drug approval. Tell us about that.
Well, from the time he was in Congress, then Representative Burr was very active in the FDA reform movement. And one thing that he was looking very closely at was the time it takes to approve new drugs that go through the pipeline, that there were a number of trials and testing and things like that that required drugs to be proven both safe and effective before people could use them. We've seen in some states enacting measures that are called the right to try, and that is if a drug has gone through the process of approval and is safe, then people who are terminally ill could be allowed to use them even if they haven't necessarily been proved effective. Because people who are probably going to die anyway, why shouldn't they have the opportunity to have some sort of treatment that might make reduce their pain or cause some reduction in suffering, or possibly even have some reversal of the symptoms that they undergo? Now, this is something that that Senator Burr might consider working on at the federal level, because he certainly worked on improvements in health care for people, families who have children with autism and other sorts of disabilities and things like that. And this would be something that would be right up his alley, because he certainly has favored fast approval of drugs that are safe. And speeding up the Food and Drug Administration's process by doing things like allowing contractors to do some of the approvals rather than have the government do all of them. And measures like that, which at the margins can bring life-saving cures to market a lot faster.
Now, Senator Burr, of course, sits in the U.S. Senate. He'll be there for another six-year term. The Senate, of course, gets involved in approving nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court. And now, with Donald Trump preparing to become the 45th president in January, we know that there's a vacancy right now on the U.S. Supreme Court due to the death of Justice Antonin Scalia earlier this year. But there's also talk, Rick, that this new president could potentially have more seats that he would fill should there be retirements from one or two other current justices. So let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court. Donald Trump on the campaign trail actually put out a list of people that were potential nominees. First of all, why did he do that, and what do you make of those folks?
Well, what he did was he wanted to reassure conservatives that he was going to look at making the court into something that is more of his vision, and that's one reason that we have elections, is because that allows the president to make appointments and nominations to different executive and legislative branch positions. And what this was to do was to reassure conservatives that he was actually going to look at judges and justices who would not be legislators, if you will, who would be people who would interpret the Constitution and interpret the law fairly strictly. He listed Justice Scalia as his model justice. And he named a number of people who would be very effective in that regard. Also, I think he had to reassure people because at one point he sort of flippantly said that he thought his sister, who's an appellate court judge,
right,
would be a great Supreme Court justice, and she's very liberal.
Right.
And so I think he had to sort of offset that a little bit. But he actually provided some names of some very thoughtful people who would be, I think, very acceptable to a Republican Senate and who would also be very much within the mainstream of the judiciary. And so I think he'll be ready to roll with that pretty quickly. Now, the question then becomes, will incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell bypass the 60-vote, not rule, but the 60-vote gentleman's agreement, if you will, among senators, that you have to do that to prevent a nomination from being going to the floor and being debated and going forward.
Now, also, it's not just the Supreme Court that the new president would be able to nominate folks for. The federal judiciary at this point has a little bit more than 100 vacancies. So it seems like the new president would be able to have quite an impact on the federal courts.
That's right. I mean, with 100 vacancies either at the trial court or appellate court level, then this new president is going to have his work cut out for him. He's really going to have to work very quickly on vetting potential candidates, for these judicial positions and getting them in place. And this is not a quick process, because I've lived through this in other areas in which there were openings on a court. And because of the process of vetting, of doing background checks, of making sure that everybody passes security clearance, that sort of thing, this process takes months. And so this is something that they may try to do even during the transition period, is to try to start the process for getting potential judges ready for confirmation very quickly.
It's going to be a fascinating time over the next several months for sure. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. And, of course, you can read all of the Carolina Journal stories and commentaries at carolinajournal.com. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing. Not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. 7 months after arriving in Chapel Hill, Margaret Spellings faced the official installation ceremony as president of the University of North Carolina system. She responded with a speech asking some big questions.
What if all North Carolinians reach their full potential? What would that mean for our state? And what would it take for us to get there? What if all of our citizens at any age could get the kind of education they need, when and where they need it, at a price they can afford? What would it mean for their lives and careers, for their families and their children? And what would it mean for our economy, for the civic and cultural life of our state, for our competitiveness and prosperity?
Spellings reminded her audience of the UNC system's role.
We have a constitutional mandate to provide a quality education as free as practicable. At his own inaugural, nearly 30 years ago, President Dick Spangler, who's here today, defined that promise very simply, that no one in our state is denied a college education because of a lack of money. Are we keeping that historic promise? Are we living up to that ideal? Or has that challenge only deepened in the past 3 decades? I don't raise these questions because I doubt the greatness of the University of North Carolina. I raise them because I believe in it so deeply.
Spellings says UNC has been an education leader since the 18th century.
We must lead again in recognizing quality higher education as a new civil right, a vital part of our founding promise. That means making education possible for all, everybody. And that's never been done before. Not here and not anywhere else.
That's UNC System President Margaret Spellings speaking at her official installation ceremony in Chapel Hill. Spellings says North Carolina has one of the finest university systems in the country.
We also have far too many citizens whose lives and ambitions are limited by geography, by income, by struggling K-12 schools, or by tuition that seems out of reach. We can do something about that. It can be easy to forget when you live in a thriving region like this one or attend one of the state's top high schools, but most North Carolinians don't have a college education or the opportunities that come with it. We can, and we must, do something about that. The opportunity to pursue an education beyond high school is far from equal across our state. a high school senior in one county can be twice as likely to earn a college degree as a student in a neighboring district. Statistics are not destiny, of course, but a few miles can make a world of difference, and we cannot allow a child's future to be dependent on zip code. Nor can we afford to let economic hardship limit potential. Today, we are leaving behind thousands of capable students who never even apply to college because it doesn't seem possible for them. Low-income students enroll in college at far lower rates than their wealthier peers, even when their academic performance and test scores are the same. That is a tragic waste of talent, and we absolutely must do something about that. At a time when our state and nation are growing more diverse, when the school-age population of North Carolina is 50% minority and growing, we absolutely cannot tolerate pernicious gaps in opportunity.
Spellings looks for a new focus on higher education.
It's time to raise our expectations once again. Higher education is the next frontier, a new civil right. Every child must be able to reach beyond high school. That has to become our expectation, our promise for a rising generation. That may mean a four-year degree, a master's, or a doctorate. It could mean an associate's degree or a professional credential. Whatever form it takes, quality higher education has become a critical measure of our standing in the world. And after a century of leading the way, we've begun to fall back. For our most vulnerable citizens, the cost of higher education is daunting. We know that college can be life-changing for those who graduate, opening a world of possibility that echoes across generations. But it can also be life-altering for those who don't graduate, leaving them indebted and adrift. As the cost of college has risen, so too has the cost of failure. We must lower the risk of pursuing opportunity.
Spellings focused on key challenges.
For too many students, those who borrowed and didn't graduate, those who spent too much time and money before finding their way, the payoff is harder to see. Our system too often fails those who come from rural, low-income, first-generation, and minority families. They are the students most likely to leave school with debt but no degree, to take longer than necessary to graduate, to languish in expensive remedial classes, or to forgo college altogether. As long as we tolerate such divides in opportunity, the fundamental promise of higher education remains unfulfilled. We must make known the lasting value of quality higher education to a public that has grown more skeptical.
What is Margaret Spellings' role in this new world of higher education?
It's my job to help define success. What does it mean to be accessible, affordable, to have efficient and excellent and diverse institutions, to make a real impact on the economy and well-being of North Carolina? How do we define student success and hold ourselves accountable for achieving it? Answering those questions will mean thinking differently about how we do our work, how we meet our students wherever they are, and prepare them well. We must adapt the way we teach, the way we advise, the way we mentor and guide students. We must give people choices about the kind of education that works best for them. That means straightforward tools, information about borrowing, about the career prospects of different majors and degrees, and about the expectations of success at each of our institutions. We must explore new ways of making education available to working men and women, returning veterans, to parents and professionals. We need creative partnerships with community colleges, local governments, businesses, nonprofits, faith-based organizations, our K-12 system, and civil rights leaders to raise expectations of higher education for all.
That's UNC System President Margaret Spellings speaking at her official installation ceremony in Chapel Hill. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Republican Richard Burr will serve a third and final term as North Carolina's senior U.S. Senator. Burr defeated Democrat Deborah Ross to win his latest six-year term. On election night, Burr already started looking forward.
We don't know what we might face in the nation ahead. But we know this, that for over 240 years, Americans have always risen to the challenges whichever way they came. We'll not retreat in our commitment to the cause of freedom, to be one nation where liberty and justice is available to all. As Americans, we literally breathe the air of freedom every day, unlike so many other nations. Its courses through our veins, and thousands of Americans have shed their blood to guarantee we keep our liberty. Our hearts swell with pride knowing we live in the greatest land ever known to mankind. Campaigns are about differences between the candidates. But now that the election's over, it's time to move forward with solving the very real problems that we face as a nation. Those of us who serve as elected officials must do so in a way that positively affects all of our citizens, for that's our obligation and it's our responsibility. We should be prepared to make tough decisions, as did our nation's founders. and so many who are remembered for the contributions that they've made. We all love America, and I'm proud to serve in some way to make our future better for all that live and to keep America safe from the threats of terrorists and to provide everyone a chance to achieve their heart's desire.
Burr noted the bittersweet nature of winning an election without his parents present to celebrate.
Even though my parents are gone, our first grandchild arrived earlier this year, and we celebrate tonight with hope of her future and the future of your grandchildren. That's why I ran again this year, to make sure she and all of your grandchildren have the unlimited opportunities and a safer world in which to live. The wheel of life continues to turn. One generation leaves the stage and another enters. I pledge to you to finish my public service doing all I can to make sure that the next generation feels the full effects of what we can accomplish.
In conceding, the Democrat Ross made another plea for her issues.
We've met people who have been struggling, who need to have the minimum wage increased. We've met older people who cannot make ends meet just on Social Security and Medicare. We've seen what the needs are of the state of North Carolina, and I am hoping and praying that this next Congress will address them.
That's Democrat Deborah Ross. You also heard from Republican Richard Burr, winner in North Carolina's latest U.S. Senate race. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The words eminent domain attracted public attention more than a decade ago when the U.S. Supreme Court issued its controversial decision in a case called Kelo versus City of New London. Since that case, many states have taken additional steps to protect property owners against eminent domain abuse. North Carolina hasn't. Joining us now to discuss some issues surrounding eminent domain in North Carolina is Ruth Sheehan. She's an attorney with the Francis Law Firm. Thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
So first of all, before we talk about some of the cases in which your firm's been involved and is still involved, let's remind people what's eminent domain.
Eminent domain is the state or the government's right to essentially take your land for the public good. And so generally speaking, that means the government will take land that is adjacent to an existing highway or in the path of a new highway for a railroad, for instance, or for sometimes utility pipelines and such.
And also they'll take it for schools or some other public building.
Absolutely. Always allegedly for the public good. Of course, the Kelo case was an interesting one because there the public good was a little bit more questionable, and it certainly ended up infringing on the rights of middle-class homeowners. It'd be like somebody coming to take my house and deciding that a development would be just the thing for inner North Raleigh.
Well, that case, the Kelo case, was not in North Carolina, but there are plenty of eminent domain-related cases that have taken place in North Carolina, some of which your firm is involved in. Let's talk about some of them. One was a taking that was on the coast, and Carolina Journal readers will probably remember this case because it involves Hammocks Beach. Tell us about that.
Right. So Hammocks Beach actually started out as a legal case. It really started out almost as a trust and estate case because it was it involved an area called Hammocks Beach near Swansboro, beautiful, beautiful coastal land that had been purchased 70 years ago by a neurologist, a neurosurgeon in New York. And he, instead of giving it to his children, he gave it to the African-American gentleman who was sort of his guide and assistant and somebody that he had become very close to. And he wanted to give it to this guide and his wife. And the wife was an African-American teacher, and she wanted the land instead to go for the benefit of young people and for African-American teachers. At that time, of course, beaches were still segregated. And so, interestingly, my boss, Mr. Charles Francis, actually went there as a young child and ended up representing the heirs of this guide and his wife because the land was set aside for those purposes, but there was a provision in the will or in the deed that if the land ever was not being used for those purposes, that it would be offered to the state. If the state declined, then it would revert to the heirs of his, you know, his own children, grandchildren, and so forth. The land was offered to the state. The state turned it down. It was supposed to go to the heirs, and then the state stepped in and tried to take it without any compensation from those heirs. And that is really the work that our firm did in trying to correct that. You know, there is nothing more, there are few things more elemental in terms of property rights than this notion. It's written into our state constitution, it's written into the U.S. Constitution that if the government does take your land, there needs to be just compensation. So we actually were able to negotiate a deal where the state ended up being able to purchase the land. Carolina Journal was really, really played a really important role in that case in its own way because it brought to light what was going on in that case and drew attention to the fact that there were key property issues there. And, you know, we're just seeing that more and more, that the government is trying to reach in, take, and not justly compensate property owners. And that's the problem, right? Sometimes there needs to be a taking for public purposes, but the rightful owner needs to be appropriately compensated.
The Hammocks Beach case had a good resolution. We're chatting with Ruth Sheehan, who's an attorney with the Francis Law Firm, and that one had a good resolution. We've also seen recently a good resolution in court on the MAP Act, which is something that you are interested in as well.
Yeah, so the MAP Act is just it's sort of an astonishing thing that was on the books as long as it was. The Supreme Court overturned it just recently, and basically under the MAP Act, a public body could not only take your land, but basically call dibs on your land and hold your land and prevent you from using the land as you would choose. Like basically they could just freeze your land and its value for decades without compensating you for that. And that is called, basically it's called an inverse condemnation. So they don't just take it straight away, they hold it. But the effect of it is that you're not able to do what you want to do with the land. You can't sell it. I mean, it really renders your property valueless.
Well, as you just mentioned, the Supreme Court overturned
the MAP Act in a case in Forsyth County. So another piece of good news. There are some ongoing cases, and in the time we have left, you mentioned the natural gas pipeline that's supposed to go through North Carolina. I believe
right.
That is leading to some litigation as well.
That is. We have some clients whose land has been affected in eastern North Carolina, the Atlantic Pipeline. And, of course, that's a natural gas pipeline. It's a project by Dominion Energy in Virginia and Duke Power here. And, you know, all the utility companies are involved in that. It's just interesting to see with that case that they are not – purportedly taking your entire property, that what they claim is that they're just taking an easement. But it's an easement, a substantial swath of your land that they hold in perpetuity. You continue to pay property taxes on that land. Their strategy is basically to reach property owners before they fully understand what's at stake, and you know, it's no surprise that the power companies make a lot of money. One of their strategies is to get to the property owners early, make an offer for this use of the land, and then they hold rights to that land forever. So that land then has a pipeline on it, and the fine print of some of those easements indicates that easement can be transferred to, let's say, to a petrochemical company in the future or to a different private operator.
We've been speaking with Ruth Sheehan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Delighted to. Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Over the past several years, fiscal reformers in the North Carolina legislature and the governor's office have passed historic tax reforms, lowering and flattening the personal income tax and the corporate income tax rates here in our state. With President-elect Donald Trump set to take office in January, there's also now talk of federal tax reform as well. Our next guest says that business tax reform is very much needed. Curtis DeBay is an expert on taxation issues with the Heritage Foundation. Curtis, welcome to Carolina Journal Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Why is it that you think we need business tax reform?
Well, I think we need business tax reform because it's the most pressing area of the tax code. It's the one area that's having the biggest negative impact on the economy today. We have the highest corporate tax rate in the developed world. That is really a strange position for the U.S. to be in because we're generally a low-tax country compared to other nations. But we have a corporate tax rate that is north almost at 40%. The average of our other developed countries is under 25%. So we're far, far above the norm. That is hurting our ability of our businesses to compete around the globe, and it's hurting us in terms of new investment here in the U.S. It just isn't competitive for businesses to invest here in the U.S., so they're investing abroad. We need to get that rate down and make some other important changes to the tax code. Otherwise, we'll continue to hemorrhage that investment, and investment brings with it new jobs and higher wages. And until we get that done, we're not going to get that growth in jobs and wages that we desperately need.
Explain a little bit more of how that corporate tax rate would put our companies, U.S. companies, at a disadvantage. In what way?
Well, for instance, the biggest reason why is that the U.S. taxes our businesses on the income they earn all around the globe. Other countries just tax them on the income they earn within their countries. We use a worldwide system. Other countries use a territorial system. So when our businesses are competing around the globe, they're paying an extra higher tax than every other country because they have to pay that full 39% rate on the income they earn all around the globe. And it hurts investment domestically because when businesses are looking to expand, whether they're a U.S. business or a foreign business, the rate here in the U.S. makes investments that would be profitable, it makes certain investments unprofitable, and they search to make them in other locations where they do become profitable. And that's what's really hurting the economy back here. That our businesses are uncompetitive around the globe, and that it's more competitive to do new investments in every other country.
Now that we know that it will be Donald Trump who will become the 45th president of the United States, give us a sense of your review or analysis of some of the things he said about his tax reform plan.
His tax reform plan is basically what conservatives and Republicans have been pushing for a long time. It would lower tax rates. It would expand the tax base. It would encourage economic growth by doing those things. There's a lot in there that there are a lot of blanks that need to be filled in, but for the most part, it checks the high-level boxes that need to be checked for a tax reform plan. I think a lot of the heavy lifting on the tax reform front will be done by the House of Representatives, by Paul Ryan. I think that there'll be a strong push to meld the two plans together, to take the plan that Trump put together and make it fit in with the plan that Paul Ryan and the House put together earlier this year, and I think that will be a lot easier done than many people assume. The plans are not all that far apart, and I think that when they finally get together, I think they'll have a fairly easy time of reconciling any differences they have.
If you were invited to sit at the table, whether it's with Paul Ryan or the president-elect, or soon to be the president, or his economics team, what would you tell them? Give us a sense of kind of the to-do list, so to speak, that would come from Curtis Dubé.
On the corporate tax front, I would say let's get the rate down and move to a territorial system. And let's not just lower the tax rate for big companies, we need to lower it for all businesses. So that includes pass-through businesses like S-Corps, LLCs, sole proprietorships, partnerships. Let's do those two major things and we'll get a big, big boost of growth.
So if they had to lower the corporate tax rate, do you have a suggested level that you believe is appropriate?
To even take the effort to do it, they have to go to at least 20%. If you're not getting there to 20%, you're not even getting below the average of the other developed countries, because states add on about 5% on average. That means that you're not even getting to the average unless you get to 20%. So 20% would be the absolute highest, I would say, and shoot even lower.
Now, you mentioned all those other types of businesses, because not every business is formed as a corporation. There's a lot of small businesses that actually pay their taxes on their personal income tax reform. I would take it that means that tax reform would need to also get into the personal side, not just the corporate side.
You can do it. You can do business tax reform without opening up the full individual side, and I think that is a possible landing spot because Democrats are not going to be interested in opening up the individual side. It's just not in their. It's not something they're interested in. There is bipartisan agreement that we need to do the business side, and that's the easier place to start. And I think the House can't pull the way to do it, so you don't have to open up the whole individual side. And I think that's a likely landing spot, a likely compromise place to go to moving forward with the least resistance.
Now, of course, we're talking about federal income tax reform here, but the states, of course, most states at least, have a personal income tax. Here in North Carolina, Curtis, I'm sure you're aware that over the past several years, our lawmakers and governor have engaged in tax reform that really has been quite historic, with a lowering and flattening of rates. For example, our corporate rate is going to be 3% in 2017. It was all the way up at 6.9% in 2011. Give us your assessment of North Carolina's reform, at least on the corporate side.
That's good. That's exactly what they should be doing. They should be getting the rate down as low as possible. It makes them more competitive with other states. That will bring new investment in into North Carolina, which will help create jobs and raise wages for North Carolinians. I think all states should be trying to engage in similar reforms. And it helps the economy, it helps growth, it helps everything. The key is to do the tax reform in the right way. Kansas is struggling with this right now. It's not that they lowered rates too far, it's that they made some key technical mistakes. And if you do that, you can end up with difficult budget situations. But for the most part, that doesn't happen as long as you get those key areas right. North Carolina has, and that's why you're seeing benefits from those lower taxes.
Are other states doing it right the way that North Carolina has done it?
I haven't followed the state stuff so much in recent years, but my sense is that most states are trying, or there are other states that are trying to go that direction, but that there is a stark divide. There are lots of states with Republican governors and Republican legislatures, and they're the ones who are trying to reform their tax systems to make them more amenable to growth. But the flip side of the coin is you have other states that are going the opposite direction, states that are more democratically led, or more led by Democrats, like California, New York, Connecticut. They're going the other direction. They're trying to tax more, to spend more, and they're having difficulty doing that because there's only so much you can raise taxes before you see very serious negative economic impacts.
We've been talking with Curtis Dubay. He is a tax expert with the Heritage Foundation. Curtis, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Glad to do it. Thank you for having me.
And that's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.